we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. We are doing the Oscar Sprint profile today of the movie Green Book, a legitimate awards contender. If you don't know what an OSP is, don't worry. We'll get into that in just a second. I am your co-host, Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
Yeah.
Also Mike. Who's been doing his Viggo Mortensen slash Tony Soprano voiceover.
The whole ride here. We just came from the movie theaters. Viggo was eating the whole movie, so I had to make a stop, and shamefully... I really brought shame down on myself.
Hamburger buns just falling out of your
just
backpack.
Just wrappers. Yeah. Nobody look through my window.
Don't look at me in the face!
Yeah, don't make eye contact with me, please. I'm ashamed of myself. But I can't deal with Viggo Mortensen, the meatball, eating meatballs the whole movie and not eat afterwards.
The Food Network has to be blocked out at your house.
I can't do it. Yeah. I do it for stretches, and those are stretches where I put on pounds.
Surprisingly, the Oscar Sprint Profile is not a diet podcast. It is, in fact, a format where we take the should-be, would-be, and could-be Oscar contenders of the year. We put them through our Oscar Sprint Profile format. Why is it a sprint? Well, that's because every movie is coming out at the end of the year right now, trying to make it in under the Oscar nomination
Oscar
deadline.
Oscar season, baby.
And that's why we are trying to get through them all, see them all, and review them for you in a timely manner. And what the Oscar Sprint Profile is, the format is to... reviews for the price of one. You get a non-spoiler section, non-spoiler review. We get a dance breakdown from one of the hottest new DJs out of Poland. I'm Polish. And the second half is always going to be that spoiler-filled review. So if you have not seen Green Book yet, don't worry. You're not going to have anything spoiled by listening to the first half of this episode. The first half is always spoiler-free. It is a non-spoiler review. We go over the performances, we go over some of the Oscar lens, and we usually start with also Mike giving us the cast breakdown, as he will today.
So yes, cast and crew. This was co-written and directed by Peter Farrelly, one of the Farrelly brothers. He has written and directed Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, There's Something About Mary, Me, Myself, and Irene, Hall Pass, and many others. First half of his career as a writer-director with his brother, very illustrious.
Favorite Farrelly brothers comedy.
Dumb and Dumber is the best comedy.
I'm sick of the retroactive editing that people think Dumb and Dumber isn't this great landmark achievement in comedy.
Well, you mentioned it in the pre-production here today, because like Dumb and Dumber 2, misspelling it, it's just a lot of dumb jokes, a lot of missed jokes, and that really takes the
enjoyment. And the prequel wasn't good, and Jim Carrey's gone a little cuckoo in his later days.
They got some great impersonations of Jim Carrey and Lloyd in the prequel, though. I was like very impressed with those two actors.
Yeah.
But, why are we talking about Dumb and Dumberer?
Yes.
And Dumb and Dumber 2, T.O.? Why are we talking about those two? Dumb and Dumber is a classic. It is funny from start to finish. The hardest laugh, one of the hardest laughs of my entire childhood.
Yes.
That stupid snowball scene. My God.
Give it a goddamn number!
Kingpin is a classic as well. The freaking Bernie McCracken, his name?
Yeah.
Ernie McCracken.
Yes.
Big Earn. Bill Murray, one of my favorite all-time Bill Murray roles.
When Woody Harrelson looks in the rearview mirror and sees his landlord in the backseat.
You think Trump at the end of his presidency is going to have the Ernie McCracken comb over out of control?
If we're all lucky, yes.
Oh,
I'm a fan of There's Something About Mary, personally. I think that's one of the all-timers for me as well. But yes, the Farrelly brothers' rich history of screenwriting achievements.
TV series Loudermilk, they've been the creators, the writer-director of that. That's with Office Space's Ron Livingston. I was not aware of Loudermilk before.
No, that's a fake show. That doesn't exist.
Yeah, there's too much TV out there. Thank God we're on a TV pod. It's just too much.
Yeah, well, we're doing just stunningly with the movie watching.
We're doing too much as movie watching, but here we go. Green Book was also written by Nick Vallelonga. And you told me, this is like went over my head, you told me that he was the son of Tony Lip.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he's got a rich history himself. He's actually been, he's got, 50 credits on IMDb as appearing in film. He was in The Godfather. He was one of the children in the wedding scene in The Godfather.
Did not know that.
That's actually one of the first lines in his IMDb profile.
I did not read much of what I took from IMDb this time.
Losers do research.
We've been doing a lot on IMDb. A lot of six
doing
threes.
A lot.
So Nick Vallelonga writes a movie about his father. And that's touching, and it's wild because the narrative is really strong for them as original screenplay candidates, because him, and I guess this is a journeyman actor buddy, Brian Hayes Curry, they write this story about Nick's family, and this is after long careers with a lot of IMDb credits as character actors. They have screenplay credits. Nick's got 5 movies that I've never heard of. Heard of most movies. You've heard of most movies. These guys have this kind of underdog feel to them. Peter Farrelly's been in no man's land with the comedies.
Sure.
The last 10 years or so. Has there been a funny Farrelly Brothers movie since, like, we were teenagers?
No, but he does have the talent in him. We've seen that. We just talked about it. And I'm always a big advocate of talented people should be allowed to try talented things in other ways. And if the comedy route, he's felt he got all he could out of that, then why not try a dramatic comedy or a dramatic role to try and get the Oscar juices flowing?
Yeah, it definitely worked out here. In terms of the cast, Viggo Mortensen stars as Tony Lip. Mortensen is, of course, best known as Aragorn from Lord of the Rings trilogy, Captain Fantastic, The Two Faces of January, A Dangerous Method where he's Sigmund Freud, The Road, Eastern Promises, A History of Violence, Hidalgo, which made my little brother cry, 28 Days Later, G.I. Jane, Crimson Tide, and Witness. Here's a story about Hidalgo.
All right.
We went to Hidalgo.
Did you?
And my little brother, who's like 6. Mm-hmm. 7, you know, thought he was tough. We'd taken him to a PG-13 movie. Now, we were showing him, like, The Matrix and Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Like, he was a tough little SOB, but he turned into a little kid at the end of Hidalgo because the horse's life is in jeopardy, let's just say.
Well, yes.
And, well, spoiler alert, the horse dies.
Oh, no!
Hidalgo. We'll have a one spoiler for this pod. Hidalgo, the horse dies, and my brother looked at me and
tears in his eyes with a quivering
lost
lip.
It. Yeah. Lost Good. It. Cried like a little kid, like an 8-year-old kid. And my brother David, who was also with us, laughed at him ruthlessly. He thought it was so funny. Now, David gets this was like a reaction to the sadness of the scene.
Sure.
So David's going to laugh to get the sadness of the scene off him. That's a David thing.
Right.
So anyway, you're learning things about my family.
Getting a deep dive here into the psyche of also Mike.
That happened.
Yeah, it happens.
I spoiled Hidalgo, but it was worth it, I hope, or whatever.
Getting back on track, though, Viggo Mortensen also a chameleon.
Chameleon.
A absolute shapeshifter. Has the ability to morph.
He was in Witness. I didn't realize he was an Amish guy in Witness. But
that works out. That checks out. He probably was just being Amish for that time.
Nominated for 2 Oscars for Eastern Promises, where he's a, you know, just chiseled totally Russian different mobster. Human being. And Captain Fantastic, where he is a humongously bearded, just hippy-dippy, out in the woods.
Amazing. Just amazing. He's another one that's it's a matter of time before he brings home the gold there for a lead.
Mahershala Ali plays Dr. Don Shirley. Ali will be in next year's Alita Battle Angel. And we love the trailers for True Detective Season 3 right now.
And it needs a bounce back after Season 2. I couldn't even get through Season 2. I stopped after a couple episodes.
Smarter man than I. I hate watched the rest of that. And it was just a terrible experience.
We're getting to the point with Ali, though, where I think he's ready to take the reins for his career and become a leading man himself. He's got the one win for supporting actor. He's probably going to be nominated again for a supporting actor.
Like him and Sterling K. Brown. Like, why aren't they headlining?
Absolutely all agree. These and I think this could be the start. He's getting handed the True Detective series by himself, so maybe he can take it and run with it and kickstart his leading man career.
He'll be in this year's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. He was already in Room 104 TV series there, and last year's Roxanne that came out on Netflix for our first quarterly.
But nonetheless, take a look at those two leads that are in this movie, in Ali and Viggo Mortensen. Just think about the roles they're known for. Ali in Moonlight, Viggo Mortensen in Lord of the Rings, and just compare those two roles to the guys you see on screen here. They look like totally different human beings.
Totally.
They don't
different.
Even look like the same family members.
Yeah. Totally different.
Like, it's amazing.
These actors are the height of talented people. He had a breakout 2016, Mahershala Ali, winning the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his role in Moonlight, also in Hidden Figures, Luke Cage, Free State of Jones, and Kicks that year. So he's getting his reps, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I first noticed him in House of Cards. He was a political operative in that. He's terrific in that. He was in the Hunger Games, Mockingjay films, and then a lot of TV before that. Alphas, Treme, independent movies like The Place Beyond the Pines, you know, bit parts and blockbusters like Predators, which is underrated Predator, by the way. I like Predators. The 4400, Threat Matrix, and Crossing Jordan Michael. He's on the come up in a major way. Like, he should be full-blown movie star sooner than later. I agree.
Think it's only a matter of time for him as well.
Linda Cardellini plays Dolores. She's married to the mob these last 2 years. She's in the upcoming Fonzo.
Yeah, she can't get enough of those Well, I guess one's kind of a hitman and one is Al Capone.
Yeah, one was used to be a sanitation worker.
Right,
sanitation. And the other one is Tom Hardy with a scar on his face.
But of course, she's not that character. She is, in fact, in our minds and forever will be.
From Grandma's Boy.
She damn well is.
And I can say a lot of things about her filmography. I got a whole paragraph here, but why do we remember her from Grandma's Boy? Grandma's Boy is a bad movie.
How dare you, sir?
It is... unequivocally bad.
I have a robot penis.
I like Grandma's Boy. I watched it probably five times in my life.
I couldn't place her throughout watching this whole movie tonight, and then you said Grandma's Boy, and I was like, oh my God.
That's a stupid movie, but it's a funny movie.
Yes, hilarious.
I've seen it like a half dozen times, like I said. So she's first known for me from Freaks and Geeks. I was in love with her as a youngster. She's also Velma in the Scooby-Doo movies, from Brokeback Mountain, Mad Men, Bloodline, the two Daddy's Home movies, which gives me another reason to watch those eventually. I keep saying I will, and I should.
You're such a big Mark Wahlberg fan.
Well, they're on Amazon Prime. Why shouldn't I watch? I should get around to it.
You hate Wahlberg!
Mel Gibson, Wahlberg. I know. And she's also in The Founder and A Simple Favor, Michael. Green Book also stars well-known comedian Sebastian Maniscalco, Demeter D. Marinoff, Mike Hatton, P.J. Byrne, Joe Cortese, Maggie Nixon, Von Lewis, John Sortland, Don Stark, Anthony Mangano, Paul Sloan, and Quinn Duffy. I just have one production note here. Viggo Mortensen gained 40 to 50 pounds.
And that was all during the filming of this movie. much food that he is digesting and consuming in this movie.
God, this movie made me hungry. Mike, you have the specs.
Specs for Green Book, directed by Peter Farrelly. He also gets a writing credit along with Nick Vallelonga and Brian Hayes Curry. Also, Mike told you that it had its debut at the Toronto International Film Festival on September 11th of this past year. It went wide in the U.S. November 16th earlier this week. Listed budget of $23 million. That's via The Hollywood Reporter. $23 million. It's not... unsubstantial.
It's a big budget. It's over the $20 million mark.
Indie award shows, sure. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out for them. It has any effect on their awards chances. 130-minute runtime on a PG-13 rating, produced by Jim Burke and Charles B. Wessler, along with the three screenwriters. As far as Oscars go, you'll know Burke, as he has a nomination as a producer for The Descendants, and the Best Picture nom got there, whereas Wessler has been a longtime collaborator of the Farrelly brothers, going way back to the Dumb and Dumber days. Music was done by Chris Bowers. Cinematography was done by Sean Porter, whose last feature film prior to this was the Kate McKinnon Scarlett Johansson comedy Rough Night. Michael, did you see Rough Night?
I did not. But it's cool that they're doing stuff with a lot of crew people from shtick comedies, right? Shtick-centric comedies. And also, you know, heavy dramas and prestige television.
And this movie is funny in true Farrelly Brothers form. I know it's just one Farrelly brother, but it does carry comedic weight. DreamWorks, Amblin, Participant Media, Conundrum Entertainment, and Cinetic Media are listed production companies, and Universal has the distribution rights. The film already made $312,000 stateside from its first 25 theater opening last week, a soft opening, and is expecting an uptick with a wider opening this weekend. Its projection last week was only supposed to be about 250,000 to 275,000. It surpassed that. Now it's projected to go about 6.6 million from the Friday to Sunday rake this weekend, and about $10 million including Wednesday to Sunday. So $10 million on a $23 million budget on its opening weekend, it has a chance to make some money.
For 1,000 theaters, that's pretty darn good.
Not bad.
I mean, you consider like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was almost in 3,000 theaters and it made $9 million.
Right.
And that was bad for that, but for this one at a $23 million budget, that's not terrible.
So be on the lookout for Green Book 2, Electric Boogaloo. The critical score is...
Electric Boogaloo will never stop being funny.
Absolutely not, especially subtitle. Not in the film world. the audacity to pitch that and greenlight that, but anyway. There has some critical scores to be hopeful of making money, but there's one that does stick out like a sore thumb. One of these things is not like the other. A 7.9 IMDb rating on 1,100 votes or
that
results.
Works.
That's high. 81% certified fresh Rotten Tomato score and 101 critical reviews, 82 of them positive. That's high.
Mm-hmm.
Average critical score is an 8 out of 10. That's very high.
Right.
97% of audiences say they want to see it on Rotten Tomatoes. Not enough people have voted on it or scored it for it to get a audience score yet. So those are all very good. So what is going on with the Metascore? It's got a 70 Metascore right now, which is fairly disappointing. It's an aggregate of 40 critic reviews. The breakdown reads as such. There are 3 scores out of the 40 which give it a perfect 100, another 9 scores that give it an 85 or higher, and another 14 scores on top of those which give it a 70 or higher. So 26 of the 40 critic scores are 70 or higher.
And 12 super high.
Of the remaining 14 scores, 10 give it a 60 or lower, which include 2 50s, 1 40, and the low man of a 30 from Richard Brody of The New Yorker.
So 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this movie is your every year kind of Oscar feel movie, right? It's your feel good, telling a story about good moral values or moral values where you that you want to project.
Yeah, you're kind of spoon feeding the known.
And now it's a bit polarizing because we've seen that movie 20 times. Everybody's wiser in terms of looking out for these movies, and they've started to piss people off, rightfully so, because some of them have won over others that should have won.
And especially when you have the disappointment, too, when you have the setups for a chance to go deeper than other movies do go in important subjects, and you maybe don't do that. That's going to polarize. Yeah.
Like you're saying, the typical river-wide compromise candidate, which is going to be a thesis statement kind of for this Oscar lens coming up. The movie's done really well at the film festivals, Toronto, Hollywood Film Awards, Boston, Denver, St. Louis, Philadelphia, Austin, Heartland, New Orleans, Mill Valley, Virginia, Middleburg, Twin Cities, and Santa Barbara. They've all awarded this movie. Of course, it got the People's Choice Award at Toronto.
Yeah, usually when we list off cities like that for the awards profile, it's us saying it was nominated. This won. Everything that you just mentioned, including, like you said, the big one, the People's Choice Award at the Toronto International Film Festival, where it beat out A Star Is Born.
And that's an indicative of the Best Picture race kind of award over the years.
It's certainly at least suggestive. Yeah, yeah. Without question.
We've talked about that in a previous like Hot Takes or Oscar Race Update or something in the past, where that award says something, and maybe it will, maybe it won't, but I'm seeing two different narratives with these critical scores. It doesn't make sense.
Well, the idea that you pitched, and I think it's one that's worth talking about, is it too polarizing to finish as a Best Picture anymore? Now, we're not saying is it going to be nominated, but if they're going to keep the preferential balloting like they have been, is it going to make that top five list where people can rank it? We're going to see, and that sometimes Metascore suggests otherwise.
What won before Moonlight was Spotlight, right?
Yeah.
So Spotlight, compromise candidate, everybody can agree on Spotlight. Very good movie, sure. Right? Very good movie. Yeah. Nobody dislikes Spotlight. Right. The next year, as a reaction to the compromise candidate, the indie film of the decade, Moonlight, wins, right? And everybody,
despite Faye Dunaway's efforts, yes.
Rather than what most people like, La La Land,
yeah, right?
You know, even though La La Land, you know, cinematically was as ambitious as, you know, Moonlight, you can argue in certain ways, right. But and that's why I liked it, not because I'm so white and I think Ryan Gosling invented jazz. No, not at all.
Saved it though.
Saved it. But listen, I think this could be a year where people are sick of The Shape of Water being a river-wide movie, and maybe we want to go river deep for another movie. I don't know.
And it's just weird to me that something, again, was sold on being this commentary on racial divide and classism and all this doesn't go deep enough, and that's what's going to keep it from being a Best Picture contender. That's crazy to me because it was sold on it being that type of movie that does, but we'll see.
We're trying to read into these numbers. We don't know. It's just fascinating to me that you'd have 12 that think super high on it, and then you have 14 that think super low on it in this like cross-section of the 40, you know, critics that make up the Metascores. That's fascinating. But then when you put all the critics into the pool, it's an 8 out of 10.
Here's the plot premise. A working-class Italian-American bouncer becomes the driver of an African-American classical pianist on a tour of venues through the 1960s American South. No, this is not the sequel to Driving Miss Daisy. That's actually in the IMDb profile. That
oh, is it? Yeah, they'll sell anything to you these days. Whatever, just brand recognition.
It's unbelievable, really. Morgan Freeman, nowhere to be found. What were your expectations for this movie?
I kind of got what I expected. Okay. I expected just that, a river-wide movie in a very weird way. That Metascore was sticking out to me like a sore thumb, and I am guarded, Michael. I am in a fighting stance when I go into these movies. My arms are crossed, my jowl is set, my brow is furrowed, and then, you have to melt my heart and I, for me to like your movie, and I will not like it before that happens.
Yeah,
you have to.
We're like jaded exes now after Widows crossed us so hardly, you know. But, I feel like that's where we're coming from.
And especially after that experience. And I had it like with Overlord, right? Because I saw Overlord's like 90-something percent. Right. I expected a movie.
Right.
You made me expect an A movie with the 90-something percent and the high critical numbers there, and then I get like a solid movie. I got a B minus.
You've been bringing him up in pretty much every episode recently, but are you and Ryan Terry in a fight now?
No.
Is this a quarrel?
The thing is, like, Ryan Terry puts like a B plus on a movie. I have a B minus on a movie. I have a podcast where I am just a jerk of a person who has to be mad at a B minus movie when I didn't get a B plus.
So sponsors, if you're listening.
We have a job to do, Michael.
No, I agree. I say that in jest, but we're honest and we're always honest. And no, that's but
that's
what we sell,
so that's what's funny, because Ryan's reviews are like, I have these movies in a positive light, and he puts them here, but I'm framing it in like expectations rule the day
for
me.
And I
expect it to be plus. I got to be minus, and I'm upset about it.
We are a film appreciation pod, but we promise to be honest. And honestly, my expectation was I would have been disappointed more by this movie had that Metascore, in a weird way, it helped my appreciation of
really?
It. Because had
it gave
that Metascore,
you an alarm bell.
Had that Metascore not been so wonky compared to the other numbers, I never read reviews before I go see films. I would say 99% of the time I see a movie, I won't read the review beforehand. Maybe afterwards,
right.
But I won't read it beforehand. And this one I did. I happened to read four. I read the 30, one of the 50s, a 75, and a 100, just to see what people were saying.
Wow.
And the divide... So it kind of set me up to let me know that I was expecting originally this deep commentary on these pervasive issues, very everyday, day-in-the-life type things. And it let me know ahead of time that's not what we're getting from the structure of this narrative. Mm-hmm. We're going to get great performances, and everything you've heard about Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen is true. And yes. I agree it is.
Absolutely but effing true.
If you're expecting this deep kind of questioning social commentary type thing, this isn't the device that's going to give you that.
You get some distinctions in that quote unquote issue movie of this kind, better distinctions than in other movies. And I was happy to see that, like, this takes a different angle, and it's with another dimension on the Mahershala Ali character, not necessarily Viggo's character. So let me get into some kind of overall Oscar lens here. Best Picture, it's a front runner on Feinberg Forecast, 30 out of 30. Experts on Gold Derby with 6 number ones. They all have them in the top 10. 6 have it at number 1. 4th on award circuit. That's Best Picture.
Now, you said award circuit. It was number 1, and it went down to 4.
It dropped down to 4 just this week.
Which
last week we did an Oscar
really
update.
Curious, right? Yeah. Because usually when a movie, especially a critical darling like this one has the numbers to suggest it is, when that comes out, it's going to be pushed up in everyone's mind. And this one is pushed up in a couple other categories. But Best Picture going down only on award circuit, though, is really fascinating to me. And I'd like to keep an eye on that to see what it's like going forward. Gun to my head, Academy of Mike Wan. I think it finishes in the field of 10 or 9 or whatever the Best Picture is. But if we ever got a preferential ballot from this year, it's not going to be one of those top 5. I just don't think it makes the cut there.
I think you're right, but what's going to be a definite indicator, I think, is that Best Director.
Could be.
Because Peter Farrelly right now, he's a major threat on Feinberg, 12 out of 29 on Gold Derby, 6th on award circuit. So he's just on the fringe of cracking that Best Director category. That's a top 5. That's, you know, film editing, Best Director, a lot of times
right.
they... you know, tell you who the contenders are for that Best Picture, you know, who are the top 5 really in people's minds, because, you know, voters don't necessarily distinguish at all times, you know, and plus when a movie's got momentum, it's got momentum and it carries more nominations.
Listen, for me, Farrelly doesn't make the cut, but if he does make that field of 5 nominees for Best Director in a year with Spike Lee, Adam McKay, Barry Jenkins, Yorgos, et cetera, all these heavy hitters, that's probably going to say a lot about how the Academy views it as a whole. I have the most problem with this movie for me comes from the directing and the screenplay. So
right.
I kind of hold that against Farrelly's chances for me. Not that that matters ultimately, but that's where I land on it.
I'm intrigued to hear how you're going to flush that out. Spoilers. For me, this movie delivers a lot of goods. Like, I laughed a dozen times.
It's very funny. Movie. It's very, very funny.
It's funny. To me, the road trip narrative flows really well. This is an odd couple that you get a lot of enjoyment of the Walter Matthau and the Jack Lemmon of the Mahershala Ali and the Viggo Mortensen. You get a lot of enjoyment out of that banter, out of that relationship, them getting to know each other. The issue movie, I think it works. It's simple, but it works. And they give you a few other dimensions that I'll point out in spoilers. A lot of teasers for spoilers so far. But basically, this, to me, it felt like a relatively smooth composition. They're pretty obvious at some times with the foreshadows and the telegraphing of what's going to happen next. I was like, there's one point where I'm like, oh, we're doing that, are we? Okay, I see that scaffolding. But it still, the movie works as a composition, I think, at least after one viewing. So it makes sense that everybody has this in a top 10. It makes sense that a top 10, top 15, it feels like an Oscar movie to me.
Yeah. You said a couple things there. Some I agree with, some I don't. But I again, as far as your thesis statement at the end there, this feels like an Oscar movie. Like I said, I'm pretty sure it's going to make the cut for Best Picture, and I would have it in for Best Picture, just not Best Director. I don't think you're wrong in saying that the through line works. I just think that had the through line not worked, it would have been a disaster because it doesn't go very deep.
Yeah, well, Hidden Figures, Darkest Hour, The Post, you know, these movies have some dramatic core in them, right? But they're relatively commercial. They follow a commercial through line.
Right.
And they don't necessarily go river deep. And to me, this feels like one of those movies. It's top 10 on my list. Really, usually those movies wind up on a top 20 on my list, not necessarily top 10. And The Shape of Water was like that, you know, maybe with a little bit of an edge because there was
you
women and fish.
You historically have the Best Picture finisher in your top 20, 25 in that range anyway. So, yeah, that makes sense.
I do, my lists and me. All right, so production values, Michael. Production design, 20th on award circuit, one expert on Gold Derby. Cinematography, 14th on award circuit. We have costume design, 9th on award circuit. Film editing, 4th on award circuit. 11th with sound mixing, 21st with sound editing, 4th with original score. To go sight to sound here, Michael, I think this movie felt like shot in the period, in the 60s.
They have one shot of the George Washington Bridge that's supposed to be from 1962 as we see that blue car going down the highway over the GW. And all the cars on the road are classic cars, too. And it's like this overhead shot. I don't know how they pulled it off. It looked beautiful.
The scope of the period landscapes with driving through the city.
Got the old school Kentucky Fried Chicken building.
With the old school Kentucky Fried Chicken soda container.
Yes.
Why can't it's a cup, Mike.
Yes.
Why can't I call it a cup?
No,
anyway,
no, container.
Soda container.
You like to elaborate and enunciate.
Liquid receptacle. I'm like Dr. Don Shirley. Good God.
So the other one that sticks out is film editing, right? 4th on award circuit. Film editing
again. It
felt
smooth. It does, but doesn't feel like anything that special. But you're right. The 4th says Best Picture contender.
Exactly. That's my point overall, too. You know, I don't know if I'm there with it, but okay, we'll see how it plays out.
Costumes look like we're in the 60s. I loved all the vintage Italian stuff. I've seen some of those items at my grandparents' former houses back in the day. I the cinematography looks like a big budget movie.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
This is a $23 million production budget, but it looks like it could be 50 or 75. It looks like a big Hollywood movie. Looks great. Like you said, the film editing is very smooth. The sound effects, fine. But the original score is 4th on award circuit. I don't remember a thing about the score.
If the original score includes the Mahershala's piano playing,
okay.
And I know it wasn't him that actually played it, but in the movie he's playing it. If that is included in the score, then yeah, I get it, because that piano playing is fantastic. But other than that, I don't think I can tell you one note that was played otherwise for the score.
We're notorious for doing this, though. We don't remember scores after our first viewing. So I guess we'll get there at some point down the line here.
Cinematography is 14 is kind of surprising, too. That's high.
Yeah, I feel like it's getting bumped up because everybody knows it's a contender, right?
That's probably a fair statement.
We know it's an Oscar contender.
Assessment.
but this movie is like in a group of 50 for a lot right. of these. And it's very, very strong. Like, these are craftsmen at the tops of their games, but because this movie has the Oscar label on it, it's buoyed up.
Yeah.
To me, it's nothing all that special in the production values, but very, very strong.
Yeah.
And really works. So performances is where this movie separates itself. I think we both have those very high right now. Best actor, Viggo Mortensen. He is a front runner on Feinberg, third on award circuit, 27 out of 29. Experts on Gold Derby have him in their top 5, 6 number ones for Viggo, Mike.
So I've said all along, Bradley Cooper is my standard bearer so far from Star is Born. I would give him the title. I don't think Viggo broke it. Mm-hmm. I don't think he crossed that finish line, but he's without question in my top 5.
Yes.
He is phenomenal in this movie. The way he pulls off that accent and his characterizations, his animations to make you believe he's an Italian from New York. And I know he's representing your people there. You are an Italian based out of New York for some reason.
He almost goes too far. Like, if he said, forget about it, I would have been upset because he's a meatball like myself, but he's almost doing a caricature of a meatball, but he never goes too far. He must have method acted the shit out of this. He must have been on set.
Can you imagine if he wasn't method acting the whole way through? Like, he's doing that with the cameras on, and then he goes to craft services as Viggo Mortensen. Like, who the hell are you?
He must have lived in this character because all these gestures work. I just watched a method acting documentary about Marlon Brando, and Marlon Brando would just go live somewhere as something for months, just like the Daniel Day-Lewis. And he must have done this because he transformed physically and mentally. He was just living in this character.
He
from
was awesome.
The way he answered the phone to the way he put out put out a cigarette, Mike. Smashed it down when he was mad and then sprinkled the dust, extra that he was on. Like, he's a savage.
Now, for as good as he was probably the second best performance in this movie.
Mahershala Ali, first on award circuit, front runner on Feinberg, 29 out of 29. Experts on Gold Derby have him in their top fives, with 17 of them having him at number one. He's the best part of this movie.
We have to have a bell in here that rings anytime somebody's our new number one in a category, and I'd be ringing it right now.
Yeah.
Ali would be my number one supporting actor right now, and I obviously am not alone in that thought, and I think, I haven't seen Beautiful Boy yet. You have. How does this compare to Chalamet?
Timmy's great. He's not at this level,
okay.
unfortunately. And this is also striking because of the choices Ali makes. He is not doing that typical totally contort my face in all my Oscar reel scenes. In front of the mirror, I'm very, reserved except for that one crack in the veneer of my face. And when he's having that scene in the rain that we all seen in the trailers, basically he's just lifted his nose. He's still trying to maintain his dignity, which is a big theme in this, that he says in the trailer, that he says in the movie, of course. And it's he's breaking down, but he's doing most of it on the inside, letting it crack through his face, kind of like what we said with Ryan Gosling, trying to keep the composure, but you can't do it.
He
so he's really
very reserved, very
living
held
in,
back.
Lived
yeah.
in.
Yeah, he was spectacular. Everything you've heard about Ali's performance in this is true. I think the script does him wrong in a couple ways.
Okay.
And that's kind of where I dock points, and we'll get into the script thoughts in a minute. But this movie, like you like to say sometimes, is buoyed and brought up by the two performances here.
So best supporting actress, Linda Cardellini, very good. 9th on award circuit, not on Feinberg. 3 experts have her on Gold Derby with 1 number one.
I don't see it. I don't get it. She was fine.
She's in a lot of cutaways.
Yeah, dare I say she was like the obedient wife. I know that's kind of a touchy word to describe someone as, but that's really what she was. She didn't want to like cause waves as far as getting in the way of Tony's life decisions. I think
she was a nagging wife. We've had the stereotype of a nagging wife. Not that you said that. She wasn't that.
No.
She's also kind of like a character that we like really early on in this movie, and there's a very clear scene where we're told by the filmmakers we need to like her. And
then
she's got a lot of goods with a lot of jokes for the rest of the story. So she's a very likable character. She's emotionally reading letters. She's got some scenes with the kids with him. And she's very good. It's just, I don't see it either.
Not near the top 5 for me.
Who has her at number one? Who call him out? Anyway, best original screenplay. Now to get in some final thoughts. Front runner on Feinberg. First on award circuit. 25 out of 28 on Gold Derby have it in their top fives with one number one, Michael.
I would like to see how that stands in 2 weeks after people have had a chance to watch this maybe for a second time or think about it a little more. I just, the polarization that we talked about in those Metacritic scores is all in the way the script kind of handles Tony's character, the Viggo Mortensen character, and it depends on how you feel about it. It's your interpretation of what his character does. And that's, if you interpret it one way, you kind of see it one way, you give it a higher score, and another way, it gets it a lower score. I just think there's some questions left unanswered. I don't know if they were purposely left unanswered. I don't know if it was addressed. I just have a problem with some parts of the screenplay as it relates to the issues that were being brought up in the movie. And also, it was disappointing to me in some ways. Like I said, I just felt like there was room for it to go deeper into some of these subjects and actually make a statement, like so many movies try to do in this day and age that don't get themselves to that point where they have the opportunity to. This one did, and it kind of shied away from it.
I do think overall it's a smooth composition. It's not really that river deep movie necessarily, but in terms of popcorn entertainment issue movies, it's a strong movie. And we were going to talk about there being criticisms that this is a white savior movie.
Right.
And spoilers, we're going to kind of break that down where we could agree with it, where we kind of disagree with it. I wonder if that is why some people are polarized, because they're just sick of, you know, the white guy having to stand up for his friend here in a movie to make it palatable for a mass audience.
Right.
Like, why do we need that? Why can't we have, you know, Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther instead and tell a unique story and a culturally specific story? Why do we need that white audience surrogate necessarily?
Yeah. It's a white writer. It was done through, written by a white guy. So
I do think there's a personal touch here because it's a story about his dad. So there's that Oscar narrative, Mike, for best original screenplay. So that might play at the end of the day.
It could. I just have issues. We'll get into it in spoilers. This is a watch for you.
It is a watch for me. Like I said, delivers a lot of goods. So I'm always going to go for a movie like that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think this is something that you could find some value in over the Thanksgiving holiday. Something that's not going to be it shouldn't be as polarizing if you go in just to watch a movie on over Thanksgiving break. You could probably take your family to this and not feel bad about it.
It's got a lot of laughs. It's got a lot of great music. Another movie. Yeah. We're watching movies with great music this week. It's a lot of great music here. And just some fun scenes, a lot of callbacks, a lot of food porn. So if you like food porn, you'll enjoy this too.
Hey, speaking of porn, here's something that you could bang to.
Oh God.
Spoilers ahead.
This is a spoiler warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
I don't know why I ended it that way. I apologize. This is the spoiler session, as Mike is still laughing.
That was like the most angry transition you've ever had on the show. Guess what? This music! This go time music!
Also, if you have that on in the background of the video I'm making, I apologize. This is the spoiler section for Mike, and Oscar's take. Oscar Sprint Profile on the Green Book movie. If you have not seen the movie yet, or if you don't want to have it spoiled for you, there's a good place for you to pause this episode, go back, watch the movie. We'll be here waiting for you when you hit play. If you have seen the movie already, if you're interested in our takes on the spoilers, or if you've just been dripping with anticipation from the first half of this, that you cannot go another second without knowing the spoilers.
A lot of people do that, by the way. I know family and friends who tell me that, like, they don't even see the movies, but they'll listen to our spoiler section.
Good. So do that more. Tell more people.
Patting us on the back.
Yeah. Come listen to us. Come hither.
They're just too lazy to shut it off.
This is where you want to be. It's all spoilers all the time from here on out. Mike, and Oscar Sprint Profile for the Green Book movie. We usually start with a carryover, but we're going to take it through the plot really quickly.
Yes.
Because the plot is not all that intricate or complicated, at least on its face.
Mm-hmm.
What we have a man, Tony Lip, the Viggo Mortensen character. He is a bouncer at the Copacabana Club in New York City. He is a family man. He has a wife and two kids. This hardworking blue-collar guy.
Used to be a sanitation worker, but now he's a bouncer, so he used used to do muscle work that was illegal. Now it's legal, but he kind of, you know, takes liberties where he makes some money on the side by returning hats to gangsters and high rollers at the Copacabana that he stole from the first place.
Yes, so that's the kind of one of the juxtapositions here between Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen's characters. Ali plays the very cultured and the very book smart, very wise pianist, and Tony, the Viggo Mortensen character, is this street smart kind of muscle thug who's always been muscle all his life, but knows his way to how to get around and how to hustle up a dollar. Viggo Mortensen, the Copacabana Club, does shut down for renovations, so Viggo Mortensen's character, Tony Lip, is out of work, needs to find a job. Mm-hmm. How does he find a job? Well, he gets called from somebody at the Copacabana saying, hey, I heard you need a job. There's this doctor out there, Dr. Shirley, who's going on tour and is going to need a driver. Tony Lip goes to Dr. Shirley's residence, he's a man who lives above Carnegie Hall.
It's like a Crazy Rich Asian room from that movie.
It's a spectacular room.
It's a spectacular room, but it's like it is basically off that set.
Yes. And Tony discovers three things about Dr. Shirley. One, he is not a doctor of medicine. He is, in fact, a doctor because he has many doctorate degrees from various universities.
So how do you get that many doctorate degrees?
Two, he is a world-famous pianist who is going on tour of the Deep South. Mm-hmm. And three, he needs a driver who can also kind of be part bodyguard, part muscle, part personal assistant because he is a black pianist. Mahershala Ali obviously plays the Dr. Shirley character. Tony, at first, doesn't think he's going to have a shot at taking the job because he doesn't like
it doing the personal assistant stuff. It doesn't go well, that interview, right.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be the guy that shines Mahershala Ali's or Dr. Shirley's
shirt. And he tells him.
He doesn't want to be the guy that's going to press your shirt and iron your shirt and be responsible for that. And Tony
says he's not a valet.
This. Yeah, I'm not a valet. I'm not a go-for boy. You need a guy to take it from point A to point B and make sure nothing happens to you during that time. I can do that. So right. Tony says, you pay me $125 a week and we can do this.
$1,000 job, essentially.
For 8 weeks of pay, yes. So they go their separate ways. Tony thinks he doesn't have the job until one day, relatively out of the blue, Dr. Shirley makes a call to Tony's house and asks to speak to Tony's wife because Dr. Shirley is considerate enough to not want a married man to do this job. He says, I don't want to take a married man away from his family for 8 weeks. I think that's too long. So let me talk to your wife and get her okay. And the reason he's so adamant to chase Tony for this role is that he knows he's going to need protection or a bodyguard. And Tony has come highly recommended from a couple sources. Mm-hmm. So he knows Tony is not afraid to get down and dirty when the situation calls for it. And he can rely on Tony to keep him safe. Tony's wife gives the okay, and so the rest of the movie from there is Tony being the driver for Mahershala Ali's character, his other two, it's a trio, it's a band trio he's in, so the other two ride in a separate car.
On a
car.
Road trip from date to date through this deep south, starting in the Midwest.
Yeah, and they go 8 weeks up until Christmas, performing all around the Midwest and south of America, as Ali is going to basically be this pianist putting on these shows for all these rich white people. That's basically the plot. That's pretty much the layout. Obviously, they get into certain situations where Tony has to end up being the guy that saves Ali from physical confrontations.
And vice versa.
Yes, and then they both rub off on each other, and they kind of find this happy medium to coexist, and they form a friendship. They form a legitimate bond between the two men.
So yes, we have seen this plot line done before many times. It's probably been nominated for Oscars before, and it has. I mean, Driving Miss Daisy.
It's won an Oscar.
It's won an Oscar. So let's start with some worse scenes, because I think this movie underwhelmed a little more than it overwhelmed as a general plot line, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah, certainly, at least for me. And here's kind of the polarizing fact and how people, I think, have interpreted the mistake of calling him a white savior, the Viggo Mortensen character and stuff like that, and how this is what's been so polarizing between the reviews and kind of struck me similarly. I just think that Viggo Mortensen, the Tony Lip character, is treated with too much of a glowing remembrance. And I think that's due in no small part to his son being one of the screenwriters. I get it.
Right.
But at the same time, to me, the character goes from throwing out glasses because black people were in his home and they touched them to accepting a job at the drop of a hat and not being able to fathom in the world a music executive would have to keep money from him to ensure that he's going to go through with this job
for protecting this black guy. So he goes from like a disgusting racist moment of throwing out those glasses because a black person touched.
Right.
Just disgusting moment.
Yes.
And you think about, obviously, if this movie was made 30 years ago and what people would have tolerated 30 years ago in a 1980s movie. We watch 1980s movies and we're thoroughly disgusted many times. And a lot of them cannot be watched today because they're so racist. And even in those plot lines where they're, you know, don't be racist plot lines, they're unwatchable today. So you imagine how much people tolerated back then, or just whatever, the society still wasn't.
The lens was totally different.
Different. So we have a few moments. They're palpable, but they're moments. And so we like, all right, this is a racist guy and he's got a big arc to travel, but he seems like he travels it too fast and he's set up for
act one. You're so disgusted that these black men are in your home and touching your glasses to at the same time, you're immediately trying to just converse with this guy who you're going across the country with and he's in your backseat. There wasn't enough of a build for me.
There's a
redemption story.
Yeah, I understand the imperative of the story. They're trying to do that pre-act two, right? Act two is the road trip. Pre-act two, in terms of a screenwriting formula, they're trying to get him into act two. So they're basically having him pawn the watch, having him deal with the hot dog scene, which is kind of a fun way to do it. Then he goes to this interview where he's vexed throughout the interview, and he gets in there and there's this man on a throne talking down to him, telling him he's got to be a valet. And he's like, I'm not doing that. Right. And he basically gets fed up and shows his kind of true colors. And again, he's racist in that scene where he mentions a racial slur about the Chinese guy who's also interviewing for the job in the lobby. Yeah. And that's when Mahershala Ali gets fed up with him. He's like, you're a racist. What am I doing with a racist? This is not going to work. You can go right then. Boom. So I thought that was fascinating. But I think you're right. He kind of goes from severe racist to all of a sudden I'm willing to work for a dime, work for the money for the $1,000 quickly.
And maybe he's not a man of principle in and of itself. And maybe the cash is the ruling principle of him. But he doesn't play that way. He has at least to me, he comes off as a guy that has the virtues of right and wrong.
You know, it's one of those characters that's a lot of contradictions because he will not work for the mob anymore.
Right.
Just won't do it. Like, he worked in sanitation. It's very clear. I mean, the sanitation is every mob character in every movie, a sanitation worker.
Right.
Tony Soprano is the sanitation company, the Sopranos. So that is basically, he was the muscle for some crew, right? And he's now legitimate muscle at the Copacabana. So he's still kind of on flirting with those mobsters. They're trying to give him work throughout this. He is rejecting them at every turn. So he has principles. Like, he doesn't want to be violent.
He doesn't want to
kill people anymore. Yeah, so it's strange.
And then in another scene, he's even more worldly and accepting when he finds out that Dr. Shirley is gay, because he's like, oh, I get it. It's a complicated world. I see all kinds of things. It's like, you're either the most understanding man in the world or you're not, and you're blind to your race.
People are complicated. Funky. Yeah, he's totally tolerant of gay people, but he's a racist guy at the beginning of this movie. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to figure out. I mean, then again, racism's pretty much illogical, so it's illogical.
It's a fair point.
So people who are racist aren't really acting logically, I guess we could say.
I don't know. Probably a decent thesis statement.
Okay.
Yeah. That was my probably biggest issue. And again, there's just the disappointment of this river deep idea that the whole screenplay presents that you have. I mean, there could have been in that Oscar scene that Ali pulls off where he's giving his speech in the rain. You have this intersection between how people who are classists view the world and how people who are racist similarly view the world, and how neither is right, and there needs judging people on their face because of one thing or another is equally wrong. And that could have been a whole depth of a conversation, of a big learning moment for both characters, because one comes from the streets, the other one comes from this cultured world, but he knows it's all a sham. He's performing for all these rich white people that he knows inherently are just deep down racist anyway. I thought that was just a missed opportunity. So few movies ever actually get to a point where they can have that scene mean so much more. This one was right there, and it just didn't.
Now, that performance was fabulous in that scene.
It was awesome.
You're right. I think this movie kind of hits those typical notes at times, and then there's nuances, and I like some of those nuances. But for me, like, some of the foreshadowing and the telegraphing of the next movement in the film, like, I get aggravated about that kind of stuff. So at the end of the movie, to start there, I knew this was going to have the glorious happy ending where Mahershala Ali is going to come back. It went like 10 minutes
too long. And you
like,
knew, yeah.
I said at one point, like when he's sitting alone in his room, like, okay, we could have a movie that actually takes a stand. Like, all right, they're alone. He's got a family. If the movie ends now, I'm like going to be so much more higher on it than if it keeps going.
Exact same, man. And then the exact same.
It was like a monotonous scene where they're eating the dinner. So I knew the movie was going to go for another 15 minutes. The longer
it went on, you're like, you're going to actually cheapen this, aren't you? And that's kind of what it did. You're right, because it should have been, or at least historically, having them end in two separate areas would have been poetic in its own right.
When they leave the last establishment in Alabama, and they have that scene where they stand up for themselves. And I'm going to talk about that in terms of best scenes. I like that as a plot same device. Here. They then have to go to the other restaurant where Shirley is allowed in. And we all know that they're going to have a good time there with Viggo Mortensen having a good time there and them having a good time there together. We all know that. We all know that when he walks up to the piano, he's going to play classical music.
Right.
We all know it. It's just totally, you know, telegraphed from the middle of the movie.
It's been done over and over again, too.
Again and again and again. So it worked. It was actually a fun scene. I get sick and tired of the conventions at times.
Yeah.
And this movie really just shouted out some of those conventions. And I'm just like, all right, well, here's this part of the plot.
And it did. I would argue we're saying the same thing in that it went convention heavy when it could have done so much more. And that's kind of a combination of what we're two saying. That's kind of the letdown and why I think this screenplay will not see its name at the end of the day. Maybe it will. Maybe I'm wrong. And maybe we're both in the dark here and we're not right. But I think there's enough to be disappointed with.
Okay, well, let's get into some best scenes, though, because, yeah, I mean, we're a little disappointed, but a lot of goods delivered.
Certainly.
The food jokes, folding the pizza, Michael.
You
laughed so hard. We actually argued pre-production.
Yes.
About what you laughed most about. You don't even realize
Yes. You
laughed the hardest at the folding of the pizza.
There's a scene. First of all, Viggo Mortensen is eating throughout this entire movie.
The whole movie.
He's eating throughout
the entire movie. Did he gain the 40 pounds during the movie? I really wonder that.
He's eating fried chicken, pizza, sandwiches.
Big bites.
Yeah.
Big on-screen bites and swallows.
I think we need to do this scene again.
I was
a sandwich.
Starving walking out
There's
of this.
One scene where he's sitting in bed, and he's got a full pizza to himself, and he just takes the thing, and every man's dream just folds it up and starts eating it like a little calzone sandwich. Oh, it was glorious.
Oh, it was so funny. He's just every sandwich. That's the Sopranos, by the way. I mean, if you ever watch the Sopranos, they're eating constantly. It's wonderful.
That was hilarious.
Yes, the food goods delivered.
And I like that they had funny, legitimately funny parts in this movie that weren't just reliant on the race conversation. They did funny things.
It's an odd couple thing.
Yeah, I really like that. It was about the two characters playing off one another.
If it was 48 Hours or something from the 80s, then everything would have been about the race thing the whole time. But this is the odd couple. This is, all right, I'm gonna talk about your diction. I'm gonna be the snooty guy, and you're gonna be the simple guy, and I'm gonna be the guy who's never had fried chicken, and you're gonna be the fried chicken guy. And he's telling war stories, and he's telling all his bullshit artist stories, and they're all good, and it really flows. And this movie's moving fast for me.
Yeah,
it really is.
Pacing wasn't an issue. I agree.
The flow works now. We know that when he walks into that shop, the tuxedo shop, we know what's going to happen. And it's another telegraph scene. But I like the way that they built his music up. I really like that. Like, we see him performing. I don't know what kind of how you'd classify the music. It's not classical music, but it's popular music.
It was awesome, whatever it was.
Awesome, just awesome. And every song is awesome. And then when he actually plays the classical music, you're like jaws on the floor. My God, I never thought of classical music like of such another caliber.
Yeah, yeah, it's very close to like rock and roll.
And then crazily, he actually jumps in with the jazz band and kills it. And he's playing like the the Johnny B. Goode piano solo there. Or Johnny
Even though
B.
he's never heard
solo.
Of Johnny B. Goode and never heard of
exactly.
Little Richard, I mean. And I enjoyed all the musical scenes as well. I also enjoyed his... he's another guy that lives by a code, even if his code gets a little judgy at times, but he's very dignity. You can't win with fists. You always need to stay dignified. And it's that Michelle Obama idea. When they go low, we go high. And that's kind of what he tried to aspire to do, even though he was hiring a guy purely because he's physical and violent. But that's a different you know,
dichotomy. So my favorite thing about this movie is the Mahershala Ali's character because of all the dimensions. We have seen...
He is very, very but rounded.
Here's the thing. We've seen that character from Thurgood Marshall and Chadwick Boseman a year ago in Marshall. They've been superhero characters before, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have been faultless. They have been someone you watch and you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe their heroism. And that those are important movies too.
And those people do exist.
And they do exist. But they do have flaws. Everybody does. Sure. And this character is thoroughly well-rounded. This character looks down upon, like the snootiness works. When he looks down upon Vigo and they get in all those tiffs, you have a well-rounded character. He's an alcoholic. He's a raging alcoholic. You don't know why, but you know that he's very antisocial at night, especially when he's drinking. And that's upsetting. But what I really loved about this character, and you always want to understand this, like what gives a person the courage to want to hit the hornet's nest, right? Like you think about it. You can't help but think about it, especially as a white person who hasn't had to deal with any of this, right?
Mm.
What would make her sit on the front of the bus? What would make him go to, like when he could play New York City venues and live comfortably and happily.
What's the calling of courage there, yeah.
And what's yes, they point? State the theme later in the movie for his character. Like it's the dignity, but it's also he wants to change hearts. Mm-hmm. And that means something. But they actually show you how he needs to. And I thought that was fascinating because and that's why he chooses Tony. He knows Tony's a racist, but he also knows, you know, this is a person that he can respect and he thinks will respect him. And they could meet in the middle. And this is it just from point A to point Z, that character learns how to relate to the opposite side. That's why this, you know, this movie is as close to a branch across the aisle as I've seen in movie watching in terms of, you know, whatever, a quote-unquote liberal premise. But if the problem is the framing of it as liberal to conservative, right, as non-racist to racist, that's never going to work in terms of a real olive branch. But if somebody actually did, who was racist, actually watched this movie, I think they would learn something.
Could be impacted, yeah. It's very possible. You'd like to think so anyway, certainly. And I also think as far as it relates to the characters, he felt the need. I mean, when he's in there and giving that speech and he's like, if I'm not black enough and I'm not white enough and I'm not man enough, then what am I? I think he feels like he's kind of being defined by his courage, or at least the need to judge others and assume that he's of a higher caliber, because he's being constant. If he doesn't think that, then it fears he'll believe, he'll buy into all the fake racism and all the smiling at one. Can you perform for us one second, but you can't eat with us the next?
Right.
Like, I think his character feels like he's out on a ledge and on the edge of a knife.
And
I
love that, because when you're at your rock bottom, you have no way out. I mean, that's kind of depression, right? I mean, whatever your depression is, however you classify it, I mean, psychologically, what you do is you do not give yourself a way out. You basically write yourself into a corner. You put yourself into a corner where he's like, there's no right answer for me. And that's why I'm just going to say fuck it and drink every night. And that's why I'm not going to fall in love. And that's why I'm not going to do this. And his character learns to forgive the slights, to forgive in order to achieve the larger goal. In order to become friends with Tony, I'm going to have to tolerate him mispronouncing words. In order to become friends with Tony and change his heart, I'm going to have to compromise. And he does compromise throughout. So he's very wrong in that scene. He's basically at his rock bottom and he's wrong about himself in that scene. He does have the courage to become one of his own people. Now, it's a very obvious scene where he goes to the restaurant with all the African-American characters and becomes one of his own people, essentially, right? And it's a very overt scene.
But it was important, too, because that was the first time he genuinely smiled while performing.
Yes.
As opposed to the fake smile. So I think there was a lot of subtext in there, too. But yeah, I think you brought up a lot of good points. And he is really a character that's kind of grasping for an identity, as much as Tony is sure he has one.
But it's just good to see the character like that not just be an ideal, not just be a superhero.
I agree. And I also appreciated at the end, and to kind of I guess as a way of wrapping up and kind of criticize this white savior notion that people are under the...
Yeah, I don't see it.
I don't either. And Ali has the final decision, really. I mean, he gives it to Tony, but it's his decision to give it to Tony.
So you're talking about the Act Two crisis, and the dilemma there is, yeah, do they lose money, and he loses money for Tony as well, and break their contract, or and to take a stand, again, lesser of two evils, or do they say, fuck it, and leave, right? So they do leave, they go to the other place. He gives that decision to Tony,
yeah,
which was interesting, and it makes sense for the protagonist to make that decision structurally. Now, last scene in the movie, Tony has been changed, and it's given to Mahershala Ali. It's kind of like the structure of Three Billboards, where I'm not going to give away too many spoilers.
I actually didn't think of that, but that's a good point.
It's given away to another character. Yeah. We think one character's the protagonist, and it's given away to, you know, in a love story. That often happens. And this is a buddy love story, but it's a love story. And same thing with Three Billboards, buddy love story, essentially.
So you're saying the final decision of whether or not to show up at Tony's?
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think of that. That's good.
So it goes back to that notion of, you know, if you let a bird go and it flies back to you.
Love something, let it go.
Let it go. Yeah. It comes back to you. Yeah.
That's why I let you go every night.
We have recorded for a very long time tonight.
Mike, final grades. What do you have this as?
87 B+. I thought a lot about it in a car ride home. I think it feels like that. A lot of goods delivered, like I said. A lot of some nuances, not enough. To me, last year's Shape of Water was an 87 B+, or an 88 B+, at the end of the day for me, too. This feels a lot like that. There's a lot to like about this movie. There's some notable things to dislike, as you mentioned early on. They kind of go from 0 to 60 pretty quick there.
Yeah, I'm 3-point curve, as always. I'm 84, a hard B. Shading to the B- side as opposed to the B+ side.
I'm on to you.
Right there. Yeah, a hard B for me, too. I think there are goods delivered, and again, buoyed by the performances, at least for me, really picked up by anytime you have Oscar-worthy performances. I'm kind of a sucker for those. So
these are Oscar-worthy, yeah. Both of them, yeah.
All right, guys, we want to know your thoughts. Did you find a lot of merit in this movie? Do you think it's a Best Picture contender? Do you think it makes the cut, or do you think it's a little overblown? What do you think of that Metascore as well? We want to hear your thoughts on all that. Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MMN Oscar on the Twitter machine, MikeMikeAndOscar.com at gmail.com, and on Reddit. We're available pretty much everywhere you hear podcasts, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, etc., etc. We want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving. We hope that you have gravy. Whether you want stuffing or not is up to you, ultimately. But if you want to hear our thoughts on that, we gave those during this past week's Mike and Oscar Weekly. So we gave you 3 episodes in the first 3 days of your week here. We're going to have a couple more on the other side of the holiday, but we hope everyone's happy, safe, healthy, and stuffed. Michael, final words of wisdom here.
So, I live a cushy life. I live an easy life. I do not live lives like these heroes in these stories of like Mahershala Ali. But to maintain my dignity, I will not fold a pizza and eat it anytime soon.
That makes one of us. Reality sucks, guys. Keep watching movies with us, and we will see you next time.
See ya.